You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
Well, this week's show is going to be about something, well, we kind of shorted y'all in the month of October, so we're still kind of got a little bit of a Halloween hangover, and we had so much fun talking about fictional ghosts, we decided we wanted to do a whole episode on real ghosts. And where's a good place to go ghost hunting? Battlegrounds. So this week we're smoking the Battleground Cigars Lincoln.
Yeah, so I got to say, I just, you know, lit the cigar and everything. This will be my first Battleground cigars I've smoked. And so far, you know, just in the first third, I am pleasantly surprised. I'm really digging this smoke.
Yeah, I was hanging out with the cigar commander who's we've had on the show. He's now a rep for Battleground Cigars, and he gave me a handful of some of their different smokes. I got to say, The Widow's Son's a pretty good one, but this is probably my favorite out of the bunch because it is a bourbon-cured cigar and it has that little bit of bourbon hint to it. So it pairs real nicely with some, if you want to drink some bourbon while you smoke your Lincoln bourbon.
I would say a nice bourbon, a scotch. I mean, you know, I'm definitely picking up on some oaky notes here. And quite complex in flavor, too, might I add. I mean, there's just a whole broad of spice, and you know, it's not too peppery or anything. It's complex, but it's smooth.
Yeah, it's made with Connecticut broadleaf tobacco mainly. It's a very dark cigar. It's goes through, it's slow cured in woodsheds for 3 months and then another 6 weeks at 140 degrees, and once the cigars are finally rolled there, then aged more in bourbon barrels. The oak from the bourbons contribute a spicy note, while the maple wood bourbon barrels add an additional layer of sweetness that is noticeable in the finish.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious to see what happens with this cigar once I get into the you know, second third and the final third. But I mean, I gotta say, man, I'm really, really tempted to want to pull the trigger on a box of these now.
Yeah, I actually had one of these for breakfast the other day. I was like early in the morning. I got up, you know, my sleep schedule is all fucked up anyway. But also, it's like 6 a.m. I'm like, you know, doing some paperwork and fire up one of these things. I was like, not a bad breakfast item.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, there's, I
don't know. Start your day off right.
I mean, you know, definitely a breakfast cigar is a thing, as well as, you know, your post-dinner cigar where...
Or any excuse to smoke cigar.
I mean, I don't even make excuses anymore. I just do it. But, yeah, I got to say, man, I'm really glad that you brought this to the table, and I've had the opportunity to smoke it, and I want many more opportunities.
Yeah, I smoked the rest of my Battleground stash, so this was the the last one. I at least saved us two for a review. And with that, we'll be right back with some spooky stuff.
Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. I am Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
Today we got a little something spooky. You know, we talked back on our Halloween episode about, you know, our favorite ghost movies, and we got thinking about, you know, real ghosts and real hauntings. So we wanted to kind of do an episode about real life ghost stories and the people who investigate them. So we're sitting here today with Paranormal Georgia Investigations. Let's go around the table and y'all introduce yourselves. And
My name is Clint Brownlee. I'm the director of Paranormal Georgia Investigations.
I am Jordan Duncan. I'm the assistant director.
And I'm Heather Dobson, the communications director.
So how long have y'all been doing this as a group?
As Paranormal Georgia Investigations, we've been 6 years.
6 years.
6 years.
6 years. The three of us have actually been investigating together longer than that. We're going on 8.5 years now.
That's awesome. Tight-knit group.
Yeah.
Yeah, the three of us, along with several others, founded PGI after being with another group and not really happy about the management of said group. So we went off and formed our own organization that we could be happy with and the way we investigate.
That's about how most clubs get started.
Exactly.
You start one, yeah, and then you, everything branches out from there.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was going to be my question is, you know, when it comes to an investigation group, how does that typically come together? Just a group of friends and, you know, you want to take the next step and, you know, work on some branding and, you know,
right,
or is it just, you know, somebody like, yeah, I got a group and, you know, all kinds of people just volunteer, or are there different setups and structures?
Yeah, there are different setups and structures, I guess. Like most groups, there's a lot of people with similar interests who have been brought together. I think a lot of us went on a ghost tour or something and, you know, became interested in it and made contact with each other and reached out and worked with another team and then branched off and started our own team. But we do have a close, tight-knit team, and we don't really have any revolving teammates or anything. It's not like people coming and going. You come with the team, most people stick around. We've got 10 people on the team, and the least amount of time somebody's been there is a year. We've got two members. They've been here a year, just when we opened it up for new members.
Right.
Yeah. And we're kind of really selective whenever we bring on team members as well. They kind of go through a 6-month training period. And then after that, you know, we have like a board.
Got to teach them not to cross the stream.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Well,
cross the stream.
We teach them not to cross the stream. That's what we do. But like after the 6-month period, you know, we have a board of 5 members and we all meet and delegate, you know, this person's good, I don't think this person's a good fit for the team, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, because it's not just a matter of knowing how to conduct an investigation from beginning to end and talking to clients and that type of thing. It's also about, are you going to mesh with the team? Do I trust you at 1 a.m. in a strange house?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a big part of it, is camaraderie and working together as a team and being able to fit in the team and be a good part of it. We've of all the trainees we've had, we've only
let go one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't a good fit. But we haven't really brought in a lot of trainees either. I think we've had maybe 6 trainees in 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty selective. And once we get a team member, they stick around. So
yeah, and you know, we always kind of say that, you know, this team is more than a team. It is a family, because we're all really good friends with one another. And we aren't just like business partners. Like, we actually hang out with each other.
Yep.
So we actually enjoy each other's company.
Yeah.
So how did y'all get, you know, interested in the paranormal and, you know, wanting to go out and try to document it?
I think each of us has our own kind of story, mm-hmm, for that. I had some personal experiences when I was younger. My grandfather had passed away, and about 2 weeks later I was at his house, because my grandmother still lived there. I was cutting the grass, and I happened to look up and I saw him walk out of the carport. I was like, oh yeah, that's cool, Grandpa. And then I realized, wait, he's gone. And I looked up and he had already disappeared, but I had seen him there. So ever since then, I've had a lot of questions about what happens next, you know, the afterlife, ghost, are they real, and that kind of stuff.
For me, it was, I grew up in West Virginia, and so there's a reason why Chris Carter put a lot of X-Files episodes in West Virginia. You got the Mothman, you've got the Greenbrier Ghost, you've got the Braxton County Monster, and my father was interested in all that type of stuff. And so I grew up with that, and then in addition to that, having anxiety about death and what happens after we die, and not having answers and joining a group like this helped give me answers as to, you know, calm me down of what happens after death. So
I probably have like the most least interesting story of our group. I grew up in South Louisiana, and ghost stories just run rampant. And I was always a fan of ghost stories growing up, and today I still love them. Like M.R. James is one of my favorite horror or ghost story authors. And as I kind of got into my teenage years, I started hearing like the true ghost stories versus the fictional ghost stories. And it wasn't until like my early to mid 20s where the popular culture had brought paranormal investigation up front. And I was like, you know, I always thought that was a cool idea. And now it's like accessible to everybody. And that's kind of how I got into investigating.
Yeah, pretty much. I always had a few paranormal experiences when I was a kid. And I remember one time I was like very sick and I woke up middle of the night and I had like this one of those old metal basins by the bed just in case I got sick in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. I was at my grandparents' house. I looked up and it's like hovering like level with the bed.
Wow.
And I'm just like, I got a temperature. I'm like seeing things. And then it fell and hit the ground and like woke everybody up and they all came in. I'm like, what's going on? I'm just like, I accidentally kicked the bowl. Because I'm like, I ain't telling anybody what I saw. They're going to send me to the psychiatrist. But yeah, like, but then, you know, many years later, I think it was like an old, I don't know if it's Unsolved Mysteries or Sightings or something, but they did an episode on like ghost hunting and me and my wife was like, we could do that. And so we went out to some like old parks and cemeteries and stuff. Mm-hmm. They all had like, you know, urban legends around them and started, you know, trying to see what we could see. But yeah, it was definitely a lot, you know, less high tech back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
A couple of idiots stumbling around the woods with, you know, a camera trying to find something. But, you know, since the shows like Ghost Hunters and all that stuff came out, it's gotten, you know, professional now. Yeah. In the most part.
Yeah. Yeah, it really has. And those shows are really what have, you know, whether or not those shows now are fact or fiction, if they are merely entertainment or not, I'm not going to say. That's for somebody to decide personally. But they really have driven the field, and they've really gotten a lot more people out there doing research. So that's certainly a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just interesting that, you know, by and large, you know, like you're talking about that becoming the forefront of pop culture and, you know, a lot of aspects. I mean, I think it goes to show that people's mentalities and, you know, the questioning as to, hey, is this real or am I crazy or whatever? I mean, I think it's awesome that, you know, we have that ability now. I mean, like Joe said, you know, as a kid, if you were to say something back then, you'd be in a psych ward, you know.
Well, and we can have those discussions now. Now, we've had investigations where the spouses don't agree what's happening in the house, and the one spouse convinces the other one to have an investigation, but the one that doesn't want us there goes to a movie, and when right. we get back, we have to leave. So, I mean, that's happened before, but at least people are having discussions about it now, and they're talking about it, and they're accepting it, so.
Absolutely. I mean, just that level of communication goes a long way. I see that with my parents, and my aunt lives with them, and my aunt's just obsessed that, you know, there's paranormal stuff going on around her, and my dad's like, no, you're just batshit crazy.
Which yeah. could very well be the case.
Yeah.
You never
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
You
never know.
That's the thing, you know, some people that are having the experience, you know, they think they're crazy or their friends think they're crazy, and then they can, you know, call people in like y'all to, you know, share some kind of evidence that like, oh, I may not be crazy because someone else saw this too.
Right.
Yeah. Witnessing something by yourself is always questionable, but if you have, you know, more than one witness, that then you're like, all right, that wasn't just, you know, random hallucination.
Yeah, it kind of hammers it home a little bit more.
Yeah, quite a few people contact us just so we can make sure they're not crazy.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when a client contacts us, it doesn't even result in an investigation. They just kind of want somebody to talk to. And yep. whether that be through email correspondence or on the phone for about an hour, hour and a half, it really puts their mind at ease a bit more. And if there is stuff going on in their house, then there's, I guess they feel more comfortable like coexisting with it.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, especially in your own house, you think that's, you know, your sacred place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I can only imagine, you know, if there's another entity or something like that, yeah, I'm going to have issues at first.
Well, in Hollywood, you know, what I tell people is that TV and movies, you know, the negativity sells.
Yeah.
So people automatically go to the worst case scenario if something like that's happening in their homes. So a lot of what we do is just calming people down and getting them to understand that you're probably going to have to coexist with this. There's no chasing it out. There's no getting rid of it. And so it's, you have to change your perception of it, not that you have to get rid of it. So.
Yeah. And most of the time you're, you know, dealing with some just weird stuff. It's not like watching Poltergeist when, you know, things getting eaten by the closet and all that stuff.
Yeah,
that's,
which
yeah.
is still a that's great movie. Yes, I love that movie.
It's a great movie. Yes. That is an awesome movie.
Now, if we have a creepy little old lady knock on the door.
And no clowns.
No, especially clowns. Since she died a few years ago.
Yeah, really. That would be awful.
That needs to be the new, like, sequel. It's like, it's her ghost on the phone. So when y'all go, when someone contacts you and wants something investigated, what is y'all's typical methodology? Like, what's the steps y'all go through in an investigation?
Well, someone will email us and they'll, you know, in an introductory email, tell us what's happening. And we have a case manager and she'll call them back. They'll set up a time to call. And we actually have an interview list, a list of questions that we do over the phone. Some as personal as, do you take any recreational drugs? What kind of prescription medication do you have? Do you have any medical problems that might cause hallucinations or anything of that nature? And of course, that's information we keep private. But then we ask about the activity, who's living in the house, the ages, how old the house is. And after we have those questions answered, then we set up an investigation. And of course, we go in and we try to debunk everything as much as we can. If we can't debunk something and we end up getting evidence, video, audio, personal experiences, then that just validates what the client's going through. And we present them with a final report. And we even take into account weather information, geologic information at the site. The night of our investigation, was there any geomagnetic activity? Because we're trying to put together raw data that we could possibly correlate to paranormal occurrences. And we give them a final report, and where they go from there, it's up to them. If they want to have the house cleansed, they can contact their clergy if they want us to come back. And even if we don't get any evidence, that's not out of the ordinary. Most of the investigations we do end up with no evidence whatsoever. It's, sorry, we didn't find anything. We're only there for a short window, whereas you're living there all the time.
Yeah, ghosts don't operate on a timetable.
Exactly. They don't appear on command. So, but, you know, in all of this, we make sure that the client is calm and very understanding of what's happening and everything. I mean, we've never had a violent case. It's all been very benign. Violent paranormal cases are so extraordinarily rare, and we're lucky to have never come across one. So, but anyway, that's, you know, it in a nutshell very quickly.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So, you know, as far as, you know, the paranormal goes, I mean, I certainly, you know, there have been reports, you know, dating back, like the Bell Witch. That's probably mm-hmm. one that most people can relate to, but
right. I still want to go take that tour.
You know, as far as entities, paranormal and stuff like that goes, I mean, you know, what are, you know, some of the different things that people, you know, talk about? What would be considered, you know, paranormal? Just anything that you can't explain based on those right. underlying factors, or, you know, is there more to it?
Paranormal is a very umbrella term.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, para means out of the normal. Yeah. So it's, you know, we can't explain it by squirrels in the attic or a refrigerator that's tilted the wrong way and opens because it's, you know, off level or anything like that. If it's something we cannot explain through natural means, then it's paranormal. Does that mean it's a ghost? I don't know. And then there are a lot of theories out there as to what is causing this. And, you know, we have different type, you know, haunting classifications. And I mean, yeah, we could go on for hours. So it's, but mainly what we deal with are intelligent and residual hauntings. So an intelligent haunting is someone who has not yet crossed over, who will actually interact with you. You ask a question and you get an answer. Whereas a residual haunting is more of a tape recording. It's an activity that occurred in the home or the location over and over again, or it was a, you know, sudden death that gets reenacted. And that's really not a spirit. It's just the energy replaying itself, if that makes sense. So
yeah, because you know, electromagnetic fields or whatever. Right. It kind of, y'all use what EMF detectors, because ghosts kind of typically deal with that, you know, electromagnetic field. And like the residual hauntings, like you said, just like a tape, tape recorder for anybody who knows what a tape actually is anymore. It's like,
really.
The music is recorded as a magnetic signal on a tape. But yeah, that's pretty much, with the correct environment, correct materials, whatever, the environment can actually record an instant, much like your video camera or whatever. And when the conditions are right, you get a replay of a past event. And, and that's like the ones you hear about, things walking through walls and stuff, because back when this originally happened, there wasn't a wall there. That was a door or a living room or whatever. Right. Ghosts don't care if you remodel.
Some of them do, actually.
I had read a story kind of a similar vein where I guess a house on a property was torn down and then a newer house was built. And they were both two-level houses, but somebody had woken up and saw a spirit from the torso just dragging across the hallway of their second home.
It's
going to
be more disturbing than seeing something.
But it wasn't like dragging. Like, he wasn't like clawing himself, but he was just like, his torso up was just gliding on the hallway floor. And then they came to realize that the house that existed, the second floor, was a little bit lower. So he was walking on the old second floor.
Where he should have been.
There's a restaurant here in town now that's an old house from like the 1800s that they rebuilt. And when they were in the restoring it for the restaurant, there was somebody stopped to take some pictures of it, and they see this guy walk through the like living room of the house, but there was no floor in it at that time because they ripped off all the floors. Mm-hmm. So it was just a big open pit, and this guy walks right across the dining room like the floor was still there, and they're like, yeah, that's not right. I'm going to get
That's cool.
Done taking photos today. We're out.
Yeah.
So do you guys have any favorite stories or anything of that nature?
Many. We all do. We've all had different experiences, and I don't even know which one to talk about. Our the one that we were all there at the same time to witness was a door opening at Old South Pittsburgh Hospital, and we were all there when that happened. And Clint actually filmed it, and it's on our website. It's on our YouTube channel. For those out there listening, you can go look at it. But we were at Old South Pittsburgh, and we had decided, okay, let's get something to close one of the doors on opposing sides of the hallway. So I'd gone to one door and opened it, and Jordan tried to open another door, and it wouldn't stay open. So he closed it, and in the video, you can hear him closing the door, and you'll hear it, click. And it wasn't a doorknob. It was,
one of those big industrial, this is a hospital door, so they're heavy.
Yeah.
Really heavy door with the
really
handle.
Turn
for
that
the
handle down to open it.
So,
And even whenever, because you came over and I was just checking out the room to make sure no one was in the room. I was, making sure that the door latch hadn't been tampered with either. Right. So, and as I closed the door, I even pushed back on it. And you can see it in the video that I pushed back on the door.
Yeah.
And then I kind of walked back towards where everyone's congregating.
And this was about 8:30 in the morning. We had been there all night. We were sort of tired, and we decided to do this final push of an EVP session. So we all congregate down in the middle of the hallway, and then we ask something to close the door. Well, what happens is you hear the door on the other side that he had closed, you hear the doorknob turn, and the door opens, and you see light pouring through into the hallway, and you hear the door actually slam on the wall twice, and then it stays open.
Like somebody pushed it hard with some force.
Yeah. It was
crazy.
That's a heavy door. Yeah. Yeah, so we were all that's where one of our favorites, where all three of us were there together.
And on the video, you can hear us like cheering. Yeah. That was, at that point, we had been investigating together for almost 5 years, mm-hmm. and we had not come across one solid piece of video evidence. And that was our first one. And so when we saw it, we thanked whatever happened. Thank you. Excited. And then we all clapped and cheered.
I think that's where we're going back to later this month. And I think that we're going to do that same hallway, but we're going to close all the doors down the length of the hallway and set cameras on it all night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And see what else
because
happens.
The caretaker who lives there, or who at one time who lived there, you know, they that was their home, yeah. And they would, you know, a couple times at night check the grounds and everything. And her baseline was to have all the doors closed because that meant to her there's nobody here. And she said there would be so many nights, okay, before we go to bed, let's shut all the doors, all three floors, and then they'd do the walkthrough a few hours later, and there'd be a door open over here and a door open over here. And
yeah, I mean, that's something I always have a habit of, like, make sure everything is, like, closed exactly. When I go to bed. And I lived in this house for a while that was, it was very haunted, at least to me anyway. And that was one thing that used to happen. I would, like, go to bed, everything would be shut, and I'd wake up, and, like, my door would be closed, but all the rest of the other bedroom doors, they would all be, like, wide open.
Wow.
Like, you could hear, it sounded like somebody flipping a Zippo in the house occasionally. It's like, there was always, like, this weird stuff, like, sounds coming out of the bathroom at random times. Like, the faucet in the kitchen would turn on and off by itself. Sometimes nice. The light would turn on and off by itself. I was like, yeah, this. But it was funny because it got to the point, like, because, you know, you just get used to the stuff. And, like, it got to the point where I'm not going to bother you. You don't bother me. And it never would do anything when I was home. But if I had friends come over and when I wasn't around, it would, like, screw with all my friends.
See, that's a good freeloading spirit roommate to have.
Yeah.
That's good.
Like, I had a friend come over and I was like, well, I got to work tonight. But, yeah, I was working a night shift. But if you want to crash on the couch, you know, go for it. Yeah. So I come back the next morning, and he's, like, sitting in the middle of the living room with, like, my shotgun, like, completely freaked out. So I was like, dude, after you left, like, some started banging on the walls, and doors were open. He was, like, just completely freaked out. I'm like, oh, that's my other roommate. Don't worry about it. He's just messing with you.
Nah, you'll never see him. It's fine. Yeah. I think one of the first times that I actually had something happen to me on an investigation was whenever we did the Titanic Aquatic exhibit, mm-hmm. back when it was on display at the aquarium. I don't know if you guys got a chance to go check it out.
I wanted to check it out and hang around. I want to go see that. I want to see that bodies exhibit. Down
yeah,
there.
I want to see the bodies exhibit too. That looks pretty cool. But we were there we investigated there like two or three times.
Yeah.
More than that, I think.
Three or four.
Yeah. Well, it was like one of the first times. It was in the second to last room. You know, our investigators, we were all sitting in a circle. And I said, you know, if something's here, can you tap me on the shoulder? And there's nothing behind me but a wall. I was a handful of inches away from the wall. So you couldn't fit a person behind me. And on my left shoulder, I got tap, tap. And I turned around because I thought it was one of my investigators. I was like, what do you do? Whoa. And, you know, and that was one of the – that sticks out in my mind as one of the cooler mm-hmm. things that's happened on an investigation.
I mean, I've had so much happen or seen so much, too. I have a hard time picking one. If I had to pick one, it would be the door at Old South Pittsburgh opening. That was pretty darn cool. But I've been grabbed and pushed and touched and – seen stuff, you know, walk right in front of me. I've seen a pair of legs from the knee down walk past me, you know, that kind of stuff. It's hard to nail down which one's my favorite because they're all my favorite.
Yeah. And so much of what we do, and, you know, we'll have personal experiences, but again, they don't happen every investigation. So what's really interesting is when you go home and it's several days later and it's broad daylight and you're at home with your headphones on and you're listening to your audio evidence and you hear something that shouldn't be there. That's what happens to us a lot. It happens after the investigation when you're sitting in front of your computer and watching hours of footage and, you know, you catch the shadow that shouldn't be there. That's when it really gets fun.
Yeah, so, that was going to be my research. It's like, yeah, typically what it, you know, do y'all, you know, see a lot of stuff when you're on investigation or most of it, you know, like you said, the next day when you're mm-hmm. going through the evidence and yeah. y'all didn't see anything at the time.
Right. Well, and like Clint said, we that door opening was our first bit of video evidence, and since then we've had two other bits of video evidence. So in our 8-year history investigating together, we've only seen things three times on video. Most of what we get is audio. Almost all of our evidence that we turn over to clients is audio in nature. And so we tell people, you know, the most valuable piece of equipment besides your flashlight is a digital video or a digital voice recorder, because you will catch a ton of stuff. It's just crazy.
I mean, we already got the...
Yeah, there you go.
Listen back. We're halfway
through seeing some cameras.
Yeah, exactly.
Some disembodied voices on the other end of the podcast whenever you play it back.
Oh. Yeah.
Well, and that's what I'm hoping with the one we do at Old South Pittsburgh. Yeah. In the background, there'll be some EVPs.
That'd be pretty cool.
Exactly. Our listeners can go, wow!
But, I mean, we do have personal experiences on a lot of investigations. Unfortunately, we can't really use that as evidence. Right. And, you know, we can include it in the final report if it backs up a client claim, but ultimately you're that one person that had that experience. Yeah. If it happened to three or four people at the same time, then maybe it would be a little bit more, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, quote unquote, credible.
Yeah.
But they're not outside the realm of possibility on whenever we investigate residences or businesses.
And there's times when we'll investigate and we'll have personal experiences. We'll see a shadow figure. You know, we'll hear footsteps or something, or somebody will feel like they got pushed or touched. But then we don't have any other evidence. We don't have any audio evidence or video evidence or still pictures. All we have are just the personal experiences. So we end up with not a whole lot to tell the client. You know, it's, yeah, we had these experiences that you say you see, but we don't have any evidence of that. You know, and then we have to try to talk them into letting us come back. You know, because the more we can investigate a place, the more data we can collect and hopefully provide some better evidence.
Yeah, and when you have, like, you know, overlapping data, that just makes it more credible. Right. You know, like, I heard this weird sound, but I also have video of this happening during that weird sound and this EVP and this photograph that all happened simultaneously. That's more, I guess, impressive to a, to a client, to yourselves, than just, you know, the personal experience itself.
Yeah, and it helps if you know, if you have an investigator who hears something, that's one thing. But if you have an investigator who hears something and then that something is on the audio, and so you can provide it to the client and say, not only did we hear this while we were there, but here this thing is. And yeah, it helps back up experiences. And
well, there was that one time we were investigating up in Blue Ridge, and we were investigating a house that was it was being renovated to turn into a bed and breakfast. And so there was like workbenches and everything around. And one of our investigators, Steve, sat down on this workbench. And then all of a sudden, I guess this extension cord just falls from the top shelf onto the work table, where, like, right where he was sitting. And it scared him so much, he jumped up and said, "Oh, shit." And then we actually go back and play our audio. And we had an EVP that said, "I am close." And then the thing fell. I'm scared.
Yeah. So that type of evidence is just perfect.
And that particular location, if I had to pick a location as my favorite, that's probably my favorite.
Yeah.
We, as soon as we pull in the parking lot, start having activity happen. The very first time we got there, it was still daylight. One of the other investigators and I were kind of doing a walk around the outside of the structure. Being that it's under construction, which... it's been under construction for, 6 years now?
It's been a while, yeah.
It's dried in, but they can't get a crew to stay in there long enough to finish the inside.
Because they get creeped out.
They've gone through two crews, and then they just kind of have just stalled on the project. And but they had, you know, the work site porta-johns.
Yeah.
So we were about 20 feet from there. Nobody else was around. The door of the porta-john opens. And then closes. And it wasn't like open and slammed shut like the wind caught it. It was a very controlled, like somebody opened it and then closed it. And we just kind of, Tammy and I just kind of looked at each other like, yeah, okay.
And ghosts got to go too, man.
Yeah.
I mean, we learned that from, what's that Bruce Campbell movie? Bubba Hotep.
Bubba Hotep. Oh my gosh, I love that movie.
Man, it's funny you mentioned because I watched Evil Dead last night. Oh, yeah.
Have you seen the TV series yet? Yeah, well, I watched the first episode last. I don't have Stars, but I found the first episode online. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I don't have cable, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to watch the rest of that series.
But yeah, I think EVPs is probably the coolest ghost thing. That like, when I go to look at photos, honestly, the audio stuff is just way creepier than looking at the picture.
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Especially when you have someone who... is asking questions and you're getting responses back. Can you tell me a little bit about, that don't know what EVP is, like, you know, what it is and like how y'all go about, you know, doing an EVP session?
Sure. EVP stands for electronic voice phenomenon. And what we do is we have digital audio recorders, and there's a whole bunch of different classes of recorders and different theories on, you know, the expensive recorders might filter out too much sort of a certain frequency. The cheaper recorders might record more, you know, and have more static noise, and a bunch of different theories. I've heard EVPs come from all types of recorders. So to me, it doesn't really matter. But we'll sit down in a room in a session and be sure it's pretty quiet. Everybody has the recorders on, and we start off with a time, date, and location, and who all is in the room. One of the things we do when we do a session is introduce ourselves. You know, that we're not here to hurt you. We're not here to harm you. We're not trying to get rid of you. We just want to communicate. We introduce everybody, or everybody introduces themselves. We don't provoke. We're not trying to make something angry or mad. That's just entertainment for TV when you see all that kind of stuff.
It's also poor manners.
It is poor manners. So, it goes for people, too, at one point. So
you come to my house, start yelling at me. I'm gonna kick your ass.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
You the attract water more. Always yeah. Like,
yeah. You attract more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. So
yeah, but we'll ask sort of the standard questions. You know, are you male or female? How old are you? You know, what year is it for you? And but what we found is a lot of times when we just sit in the room and have a conversation. You know, we hadn't seen each other in a week or two, so we'll sit down and talk. Hey, what you been doing or whatever. When we have that conversation, things like to join in. And so we start getting as many EVPs or more in those kind of sessions than we do by asking direct questions, and which I've always thought as interesting because I guess they just want to be part of the conversation too, you know. And
ghosts like to screw you just like anybody else.
Yeah, or they have something to offer.
And they have their opinions on what we're talking about.
Right.
What's really funny, though, is that I find that sometimes ghosts will answer the questions that you're asking the other investigators. Like, again, going back to Old South Pittsburgh, we have an EVP where one of our investigators said, hey, what year was this building built in again? And it was 1966. It was when it was built. But our other investigator went 1960, and he couldn't remember the last number of the year. So he dragged out. and then he goes, 1966. But in the dragged out portion of what he was saying, I had caught an EVP that says, 1966.
Oh, so, awesome.
And that should be up on the website if you guys want
to
hear it.
I'm going to have to check that out. Yeah, my buddies one time were recording at this place, and it was like we'd heard about EVP, so we had like an old tape recorder out there. And my buddy just got through saying, he's like, dude, if we play this back and hear Get Out, I'm going to shit myself. Sure enough, when we're playing it back, we're just, Get Out, like right every second. That's funny.
Well, and while we do our EVP sessions, while we conduct them, one thing we do several things, but we speak in a normal voice, just like we are now. We don't whisper. Because if you whisper, it could be mistaken as an EVP or something later. And then if, you know, Heather's stomach growls, which it often does.
Which it always does.
Then she might say, oh, that was my stomach growling. Or if a car goes by outside or dog barks, we make a note of it when we hear it so we don't mistake it for something else.
Pro tip, don't hunt on an empty stomach.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't matter with her.
It doesn't matter.
I took some audio one time and it sounds very demonic. And I clipped it out of some audio we had. It just sounds horrible. Something evil, demonic, growling. And it's her stomach. I use it as an example of what you should do. Here's why we make notations. You know.
That's why I don't do a live session with my headphones on, because my recorder will sit nearby and it's, oh, what was that? No, that was me. What was that? Oh, that was me.
So what's some, other than the tape recorders, what's some equipment that y'all use in an investigation? What's your toolkit that you take out into the field?
Wow. We've got a lot of gear.
All kinds of toys.
A lot of us have our own personal kits, and then we have team gear. So I'll go over team gear first. We have a closed-circuit TV system, a DVR.
Yeah.
We can run 8 cameras at a time. The DVR's got a terabyte hard drive, so we can record for a long period of time. Nice. So it's all night vision cameras. Some are wide angle, some are not quite so wide. We have a REM pod, which is like an electromagnetic field detector, except what it does is it emits an electromagnetic field. So if something passes through that field and breaks the field or breaks the plane, it will alert us. So an alarm will go off, lights come on. We have a vibration detector that we can sit on the floor. So if someone walks by or there's a claim of footsteps in the hallway, we sit it in the hallway and it will detect vibrations as something walks by. It's pretty sensitive because we've set it on a slab concrete floor and I've been about 10 feet away from it jumping up and down and it'll go off. So it's it's pretty sensitive to be on a slab, concrete slab like that. And then we have a shadow detector, which we can set up. And what it detects is changes in light. So if a shadow or something passes past it or through it, it will alert us.
Yeah, I've not heard of that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and there's a lot of other gear out there, sound sensors and other things that we're going to look at doing. One thing we want to, eventually try to build is a something that can track a entity, you know, and it will collect, you know, have a device that will collect data in multiple places at one time to see if it will move through a whole room or something like that.
We've also been experimenting with a Microsoft Kinect.
Yes, we hooked up a Kinect to a laptop, and it provides an amazing view. It's really cool because it uses infrared and will look like night vision. But the other thing it does is it measures your distance. So when you're using the Kinect, like for your Xbox, and you're moving your hands back and forth, it can tell the distance and everything. So if you look at it in a certain view, and it looks like it's from an infrared or a thermal camera, so it's different colors.
Yeah, so the closer you are to the screen, like the brighter the color.
Right. And the further from the screen, it's going to be blue. So instead of the thermal where it's like white hot, it's white is close and going through red and orange and green and yellow and blue to distance. And it can measure and see the distance so much further than it can an infrared light. We set it up at the Chastain house looking up a stairwell where like our regular infrared cameras couldn't see beyond the top steps. This saw beyond the top steps all the way to the back wall.
I heard of hacking a Kinect. That's pretty cool.
Now, I will say it's cool. Kind of cheated because, you know, we as members who actually do this, you know, investigating, we kind of scoff at the TV shows, but we do still watch for technical equipment ideas because every now and then they come up with a good idea. So some of these
TV show money to
get. Yeah, exactly. So we think we're all volunteers. We need to try that. So we try to cobble together what they've done and you know, use it in our own investigations. So
yeah, and we've got ideas for other equipment we want to put together, and it's just a matter of one, funding to get it and put it together, and having somebody that can actually build it, because some stuff just doesn't exist. We have to build it. But that's all team gear. Of course, we have tons and tons of video cable and power cords and a monitor, because we'll set up base with the DVR, the monitor. We have all our cameras. We've got tripods for all the cameras and all that. I mean, we've got multiple big equipment cases. I mean, it's a big production when we go out. But then we all have our personal gear. You know, so I have an EMF detector. I've got multiple I got a digital video recorder, and I have several voice recorders that are digital, still camera. We all carry, just about all of us have a still camera. And then I have a still camera I've converted to infrared that I use. And then
I've got a K2 meter, which is just another version of the EMF detector, but instead of like a digital number readout, it's got lights that light up. So if it detects electromagnetic field, like it just kind of like lights up like the 4th of July.
Anybody who watches Supernatural, it's kind of like that.
it's actually quite similar, actually.
And also we carry other things too, like a level. We want to make sure the floor is level or that kind of thing.
If chairs are sliding across the room, you want to make sure it is paranormal, not just a bad house.
Right. Exactly. And then some of us carry trigger objects, toys, dolls, that kind of thing, to see if, you know, like if there's a child spirit that's supposedly in a location, maybe put the ball there and see if it'll move it, that kind of stuff. But there's everybody else has similar equipment, maybe a few different pieces here and there. Like the MEL meter. You got a MEL meter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Explain that one.
The MEL meter is just, it's an EMF detector that's a bit souped up that also takes temperature. And The one I don't have, which I do want, I'm coveting, it's the Melmeter that actually, it almost like it combines the REM pod with the EMF and temperature, where it's got the antenna that emits the electromagnetic field. So if something breaks that, if it's nearby, if it breaks that field, it'll, you know, lights and sounds will go off to let you know that, oh, something's standing in front of you. Yay. So
I'm a big fan of my laser grid pen.
Yeah. The laser grids are great. I mean, you just set that up in front of a camera, and if something, you know, walks through that, it's going to cast a shadow that's very easily seen. So we like those.
Yeah. I mean, if I had all this stuff, I would just have them going in my house all the time. They're playing Xbox and all of a sudden I'm going off. Ooh, there's something in here.
Not even for paranormal, just for the whole factor.
Well, you should be alarmed whenever your Kinect recognizes somebody that's not you.
Yeah. I had a story from a guy I know that when he first got the new Xbox Kinect, he had a brown leather couch that was similar in skin tone to him, and it wouldn't detect him.
No.
His wife, it would pick up his wife, but him, and it would be like, no, you're not there.
Oh, no. Oh, that's funny.
Oh, he's like, my Xbox is racist. Oh. So, I mean, is there... You said the Hollywood typical violent encounters are super, super rare. Have y'all ever had, you know, something above and beyond the normal ghost activity that y'all have run into?
I would say the only thing I've seen is we investigated a house over in Tucker a number of years ago, and a woman who was part of our group previously, she left just to start her own business. And we were in this one home and we had separated. So we had a couple of people in this back room that the clients were using to put, you know, their musical equipment and guitars. And then two of us were in the master bedroom and two others were in another room of the house. And I heard Stephanie say to the, you know, I heard the clients asking Stephanie, are you sensitive or are you psychic or anything like that? And Stephanie said something to the effect of, well, you know, I wouldn't even know if there was a ghost in here if it walked up to me and punched me in the stomach. Well, the next thing I know, I hear her exclaim out in pain a few minutes later, and she said it felt like something just went right through her yeah. midsection. And she spent she spent the next couple of weeks having nightmares and just very unsettled, and so we think that something proved to her, well, if it's going to take me punching you in the stomach, I guess I'm going to have
to. You asked for it.
I would have to say, out of everything we've ever done, that's probably the most unsettling thing that's ever happened to our group. So, but other than that, there's nothing that's, you know,
yeah, we've
that
never
stands
come across
out.
Anything
negative,
malevolent, or I guess what some people would call demonic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Inhuman,
that's,
rather.
Yeah, that's so rare. Most of it is just people's perceptions. They perceive it to be horrible, and it's not. And also, if you're an asshole in life, your death is not going to make you a sunshiny angel. You know, you're still going to be an asshole. So if you shove people, if you were a jerk, if you scratched people, I mean, that's probably how you're going to behave after your death. And so, you know,
that's my plan for the afterlife. It's going to be more interesting.
So a lot of what people think is demonic is just, you know, something trying to get their attention or just totally being a jerk. So
yeah, just because something's like, yeah. Kind of a mean to you. It doesn't mean it was demonic. Just like I said, could be a dead asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we've had some pretty weird and bizarre things, though. Not that are, I don't know, that are necessarily paranormal.
Oh, now the people. Our clients scare us more than the paranormal.
They're paranormal in the sense of the human.
Our clients are more frightening.
Yeah, so, I mean, not all of our clients, but we get the occasional client that is... Really needs some help, and we do what we can to get them the help. If they need professional help, then we suggest that. We don't beat around the bush, and we don't try to feed them information to make them, you know, think that what they're experiencing is actually happening. If we don't find the evidence, we try to get them the help they need, and whether or not they take it, that's their own business.
And I do wonder if a lot of it is they just need attention.
Yeah,
this is their way of reaching out for attention, and unfortunately, it's kind of the wrong way. But yeah,
we never tell, kind of like echoing what Clint said, like we never tell a client what they want to hear. Like if they straight up think that they have 100% activity and no other reason for it, and we come in and we don't find anything, we'll be like, listen, we don't think there's anything here. But oftentimes they will then pursue a team that will tell them what they want to hear.
Yeah.
As noises you're hearing in the attic are rats. You need to buy a rat trap.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, I've gone so far as to say in a final report, y'all need to get a hobby and get out of this house. You know, I mean, it's honestly, you need to quit dwelling on this. You need to quit obsessing, get out of the house. So yeah, we've gone that far, but.
So have you ever had anything for the blooper reel where y'all run into something that either did not go as planned or you're like, this is something really paranormal and you find
I know what you're going to say, Jordan.
Heather.
There's a recording out there and I need to get it from one of our former investigators, Brett. We actually talked about this the other day. We went to a client's home and, you know, sometimes when you have pets that you don't take care of, they're, you know, you smell the odor if the pet goes to the bathroom. And so we'd gone up into this woman's bedroom and there was an odor of cat pee. And so was it you, Clint? Was it you, me, and Brett?
I think so.
I sat down on the floor and I realized I'd sat in cat pee. And so the EVP of the evening was me loudly proclaiming, I had just sat in cat pee. And the two of them just started laughing. And then about a week later, I get an audio clip from Brett. This was my favorite EVP of the night.
One of my favorite, speaking of Brett, one of my favorite was whenever we were trainees on the other, you know, our first team. A lot of times whenever we try to make contact, we ask, you know, can you knock on a wall or can you say knock once for yes or twice for no. And Brett said, knock yes for once. That's kind of been the running gag for 8 years.
Yeah.
Oh, I had what we, speaking of knocking, in blooper reels, there's an old urban legend about this church that's out in the middle of the woods, where we live. And they say if you go there at like midnight or whatever and walk around the church 3 times and knock on the door, you know, the doors will open up and all kind of weird stuff will happen. And of course, dumb teenager, like, let's go do that. So this was the time when people still carried pagers. So we're walking around the church and get to go to knock. And about the time my fist makes contact with the door, my pager goes off. And like, we all about have a heart attack. And I just like, that says 666. We're getting the hell out of here.
Yeah.
Or maybe you should go inside.
It's a sign to go in.
No. I was like, yep, I'm out.
We've got a few. Moments of flatulence.
Brett.
But overall, we're pretty well behaved. Every now and then, if there's a really, you know, we really get into a conversation, we're not watching our language. It's okay. I really hope something didn't try to talk to us just then, because we can't turn it over to the client with, you know.
And a lot of times, you almost get a little punch drunk late into the evening
because tired.
Most of us, you know, we all have families and day jobs and. You know, we've been up all day, and here we are, we're up all night, and you just, sometimes you get a little loopy, and the conversation generally turns south pretty quick.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'd say that would probably make for the most interesting conversations when a little bit sleep-deprived. That's when the true nature of the beast.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's when we get the most responses.
If we left the microphones on, like, after we got done recording in the middle of the night, the blooper reel would be bad.
I'm guilty of dozing off here and there.
You go to a client's house and they have this really big, comfy couch, and you just sort of snuggle down in the corner, and the next thing you know, you're snorting and, you know, waking
What's
up.
That monster sound? Oh, no, that's somebody snoring.
It's Heather snoring.
Yeah, the flip side of that, though, is the client's house that you go in and you don't even want to sit down.
No.
You know, and you stand up the whole time, and you don't bring your equipment bag in and set it down. You carry your equipment in your hand.
Stick to the floor.
Yeah, there's been a few of those.
There's been a handful of those, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, you know, in talking about your guys' investigation, seems like you've, you know, cover a vast area. I mean, is there a particular region or area that you guys try to focus in, or are you guys open for travel or whatever?
We would love for everything to be in the Atlanta area, but that is not always the case. It seems like this last year we had a lot of cases about 2 hours south of us, which was kind of strange. But we would prefer not to drive really long distances, but if we had to, we would cover all of Georgia.
Yeah, we've covered all of it. Like, we've been down to Richmond Hill, down near Savannah, for an investigation.
Yeah. And it all depends on, too, if we have a client who's 5 hours away, obviously that investigation is not going to happen this weekend.
Right.
It's going to be more of a, okay, we need to plan a few weeks in advance and, you know, whoever has the funds for a hotel and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And we have camped out on clients' floors before with our sleeping bags.
Which, and this kind of, and I don't know if we had mentioned it earlier, but we're all on a volunteer basis. So, like,
we don't charge
for our investigations. All the equipment we get, like, we have a team bank account where we pull money and whoever can donate what, you know, will. So, and that also goes to, like, driving distances. So if we're driving 5 hours south, and like Heather said, you know, we need the funds for gas money to and from. We need the funds for food. Everybody's got to have pitch in for the hotel room if we get one.
So it's all about, yeah, whose paycheck is going to last till the end of the month? Can we afford this and that kind of thing? So we know of groups in the Southeast area that we trust, that we feel like we can hand people over to. But if for some reason that doesn't work out, then yeah, we'll come where you are and investigate if you need us.
So is there, you know, kind of a synergy that happens, you know, between paranormal groups?
Depends on the group. Unfortunately, paranormal groups as a whole are extraordinarily proprietary. They don't want to share. And that's what always irritates me, because we're of the opinion that when we hand over a final report with evidence, that evidence belongs to the client. Sure, the client may have said, yeah, you guys can share this on your website. But if the client comes back 3 years later and says, take that off your website, done. That's not our evidence. That's yours. And if a client calls in another team, we share the evidence because it's not ours. It's the client's. And we feel like there needs to be a lot more communication between groups, because there's this whole ridiculous hashtag movement on Twitter about para-unity.
And it's just a buzzword.
It's just a buzzword. Yeah. And people won't actually cooperate because, okay, we have a client. We're not going to share that client with you because you're going to steal them supposedly and take away the evidence. And for us to be taken seriously, for the paranormal field to be taken seriously in the scientific community at least, we need to share information. We need to share experiences. We need to share these locations. And unfortunately, it's difficult to find groups who are like that.
Yeah, if nothing else, for the, you know, just the scientific factor of it, being able to replicate data. You know,
yeah.
So if y'all investigate a spot and then another group comes back and investigate a spot, you know, if y'all can compare notes and see both of y'all picking up the same thing, that adds evidence to everybody.
Instead of a, from my marketing and consultant aspect, all of a sudden you're able to put together trends. But, you know, more of a community involvement, it's hard to draw trends.
And we've started last year, we were honored to speak at Dragon Con and do a couple of panels at Dragon Con, and we actually launched the Paranormal Data Collective. It's a site, when you go on our ParanormalGeorgia.com website, there's a little logo, proud founder of Paranormal Data Collective. When you click on that logo, it takes you to the site. We have been trying to get groups together, because like we said, we want to look at trends. We want to look at, okay, if you have, you know, a high level of geomagnetic activity from a solar flare, does that cause a spike in paranormal activity? Is having your house sitting on a granite deposit, is that going to cause, you know, paranormal activity versus sitting on a limestone deposit? And that's a whole little...
That's a side rant.
But so we're trying to look at these trends, and it is possible to collect raw data on an investigation without giving out your client's name and address.
Yes.
And so what we want teams to do is to pull together this information, to have this database to work off of, so that we can look at trends. And then if you want to publish a paper, if you want to write a blog post or an article, hey, this group over here in Oklahoma, this group over here in New York, and this group in Florida, let's all share our data. And we, of course, will cite you if we use your data in any sort of study or article. And we've only had like a handful of groups come on, and it's frustrating because they don't, I guess they either don't want to share data or they think it's a lot of work. And it's like, it's not going to cost you any money. You create an Excel spreadsheet and you make some columns and some rows and you put this data in after every investigation and then you're done.
But kind of keeping with that, like the severe lack of people and kind of with your original question, is I find like a lot of groups in the paranormal community are quite, not everybody, but a lot of them are quite opportunistic. Everybody wants thrill a seekers. TV show. Everybody yeah. wants to either be a thrill seeker. No, there is. And I always say that there's a difference between a ghost hunter and a paranormal investigator. You know, when you say you're going hunting, you're implying you're doing something for either sport or necessity. Well, if I'm ghost hunting, I don't need a ghost, and I'm not going to eat a ghost. So, so like I always say,
can that be proven?
If you can catch one, let's find out. But I always go with paranormal investigator, which implies, you know, that you're interested in the inquiry, the hows, whys, whens, wheres, like the entire scientific method. Sadly, a lot of groups are very opportunistic, and they're trying to get the next big television show. And, you know, on one hand, I get it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing to be on TV to a paranormal investigation show. And also, you have to pay your bills. I get it. But at the same time, that's what everybody's getting into the paranormal to do, is to have a TV show. Whereas there's a lot of people who are strictly in it for the passion and the interest and the inquiry. And I think a lot of groups like that get thrown by the wayside because of the quote-unquote paratainment movement.
I mean, one of the things that, you know, surprised me, and, you know, as I was doing research on, you know, different paranormal investigation groups, things of that nature, was the sheer amount of reporting and the follow-up and everything after an investigation has taken place. Like, you know, I'm you know, one of the dumb masses that, you know, see Ghost Hunter on Travel Channel or something, and like, oh yeah, that's awesome. But what I don't take into account is, you know, something like what you guys would do for the client is, you know, the hours of extensive follow-ups, write-ups, and
we see a 5-minute highlight reel at the end of the episode. You don't see the 4 or 5, 12 hours of somebody sitting behind at a desk reviewing all that evidence.
No, yeah, absolutely. That's true.
And what's unfortunate is that if you truly had a TV show, an actual reality show about a paranormal group, a legitimate paranormal group, it would be the most boring show on television. Mm-hmm. And that's why the shows that are popular, I'm not saying they're faking evidence.
I mean, Hoarders made it, you know.
That's true. Hoarders is a great show. Well, Hoarders helps me clean out my closets.
Yeah. Well, you also don't see, I mean, you see an episode of a show for an hour, 45 minutes without commercials, but you don't see the 5 or 6 days of filming in that one location to get that 45 minutes worth of footage.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and sadly, we can't be at the client's house for 4, 5, 6, or 7 days. We're there for...
We're lucky if we get in a client's house for 4 or 5 hours, and then they're totally done with us. They don't, you know, they don't want us to come back. They're just, you know, and that's fine. We understand that. And that's the other reason why we're trying to get the Data Collective off the ground, because we can't investigate every day of the week, 365 days out of the year, and we can't do repeat visits with client houses a lot of times. So that's why we want other groups to come on and share data, because the more groups you have, the more investigations are happening. So
you know, if I'm a client or a potential client, you know, somebody that's experiencing something, you know, what would you say to potential clients as far as, you know, these are the initial steps and this is kind of the process?
Of investigating, or?
Well, I mean, just what to expect. I mean,
what advice you give to someone who is experiencing a haunting? You know, that, you know, what some of the stuff y'all tell people to have, like, you know, to deal with, you know, the day to day of living in a possible haunted location?
I would say just the main thing is just take ownership of your house, because, you know, just like we had joked, you know, you don't want to walk into somebody's house and start being mean and nasty to them and that kind of thing. Well, at the same time, you don't want to allow something to rule your life that makes you unhappy. So if you're hearing noises, you're seeing shadows, objects are being moved, you need to voice your displeasure at it. You know, you need to say, don't move that. I don't appreciate it. I don't appreciate you scaring me in the middle of the night. Just like you had said, you know, with your house and your friends, you've just got to be vocal about it. And a lot of times I think when activity happens, it's trying to get your attention. So, you know, if you acknowledge it, then say, yeah, okay, I heard you, I saw you, but I'm busy right now. Please don't bother me. And I think that's more of changing your perception than it is changing the activity. Because if you calm down about it, it's not going to bother you when it does happen. Because everything we encounter is so benign in nature. So
now, as far as what like a client can expect if we're coming in, so like let's say you call or email and you have a claim of activity, you know, like Heather said earlier, we'll do an interview. So somebody will contact you, do a phone interview, ask a list of questions. And then if we need to move further on, then we'll set up a date for an investigation. And usually we'll get at least four investigators, depending on the size of the location, maybe more. And then we would come in for 4 or 5 hours, you know, in the evening on a weekend, like a Friday or a Saturday night, set up cameras, do our EVP sessions, photograph the location, all of that. Generally, we ask the clients to leave or either to sit outside or go, you know, across the street to a friend's house or something, so we don't have any contamination from them talking. Or we've had clients want to sit in their living room and watch TV while we investigate, you know, that kind of thing. Can't really have that. You have to take your pets out if possible, that kind of stuff. And then after the investigation's over, we bring you back in. Sometimes we might do an EVP session with the client to see if whatever is there is associated with the client or reacts to the client in a different way. And then we close out the investigation. And then in, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, you end up with a printed report that shows all our findings. And if we had EVPs, you get copies of that or video or whatever.
Awesome. Sometimes, I guess, people assume that we're a television show, and sometimes we will roll up and be like, oh, well, where's the camera crew at?
Yeah, that's happened a time or two.
Yeah, that's happened a couple times.
Yeah. So. And then I remember one of our first investigations, it was a warm night, and we had set up our base unit, you know, our monitors and everything in the garage, and the garage door was open. And the next thing we know, most of the neighborhood is standing in the garage behind us watching the monitor.
Yeah.
Did you see that orb? You know, and they're just pointing things out on the screen, and it's, okay, this is strange. Yeah. This is really uncomfortable.
Yeah, like we were putting on a show.
Yeah.
It Which, was by the weird. Way, orbs are 99.9% dust.
Yeah, or bugs.
Yeah. Or bugs. Yeah. But, yeah, so it's interesting.
So as we kind of ended up, wrap things up here, is there any, like a dream investigation? Like, you know, is there like a location, historic spot, anything that y'all would like, if the opportunity arose, like what y'all's like, you know, highlight reel that y'all would love to do?
There's so many.
I know.
I would say Alcatraz.
Yes.
Oh, that would be a good
I'd love to go to Alcatraz. I've visited Alcatraz. I'd love to investigate there.
The White House. Lincoln's ghost. I would spend a night
about, like, White House ghosts. And
I would love
so much history takes place there. There's got to be something roaming those halls.
Yeah, I would love to just hang out with equipment in the White House. That would be awesome.
So my original answer to this about 2 months ago was the Stanley Hotel.
Yeah.
Because I would like to just go to the Stanley Hotel. Like yeah. Haunting stuff aside. But my new answer lately has been Disney World.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to investigate Disney World. That's Disney funny. Will never let that happen, but I would absolutely love to do that.
Yeah, I watched some weird videos on YouTube the other night where they were showing like some security cam footage that had some like weird anomalies in it. Yeah,
I actually did a podcast with a buddy of mine who runs a Disney podcast, and we talked about that. Awesome. So,
all right. So, how can people follow what you do? Find y'all. What?
Our website is paranormalgeorgia.com. We're on Twitter, paranormal_GA. paranormal_GA Instagram, and we're also on Facebook, and you can find those social media links on our website on the right hand side. So mainly just paranormalgeorgia.com, and it's a blog. You can find out about our investigators, but at least once or twice a month we're, you know, posting new articles and that type of thing. And we also have our own podcast, Ghost in the Podcast, that we try to do on a monthly basis that you can subscribe on iTunes. So I mean, yeah, we're pretty easy to find. And our email is pgiboard, so pgiboard@gmail.com.
Awesome. And with that, we'll wrap this up and be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hey, man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back. It's time for Beer 30. What are we drinking this week, Brad?
This week we are drinking Heavy Seas Uncharted Waters, the Great Ur Pumpkin.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost Thanksgiving time. You're going to drink, eat some pumpkin pie. This is a beer to go to chase that down with.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's so easy to get burnout on pumpkin spice everything. And, you know, I used to...
Get your white girl wasted on pumpkin spice everything.
I'm going to up my basic bitch status here. but, yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, I guess pumpkin's cool and all. It gets you ready for the holidays and the fall, cooler weather and stuff of that nature. But, you know, just some of the spices and the blends and everything. I mean, I don't know. In a way, I'm more of I enjoy springtime and summer. So when pumpkin starts rolling around, I'm like, fuck. It's officially going to start getting cold. The heat bill's going to rise. And, yeah. You know.
Hey, it's cold enough. We can start lagering some beer.
I just set them outside.
Yeah. I mean, I always like pumpkin pie, you know, this time of year. So it's I'm kind of, this one right here is a 10% ABV. And it's also bourbon barrel age. So it's a little bit stronger than some of the other pumpkin beers I've had. And you're also getting just a kind of a hint of bourbon in that, you know, pumpkin spice flavoring.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably one of the better ones for me, just because I do have a tendency to get burned out of pumpkin-flavored everything. But, you know, the warmth of the alcohol from, I guess, maybe some of the bourbon taste, and I'm just not a big fan of the allspice and ginger and the cinnamon that these types of beers typically have. Like, that just does not suit my palate.
I mean, what was that one we had that was just horrible?
I think we were talking Pumpkin.
Yes, that it? It was the Wicked. The Wicked Pumpkin, maybe. No, it was Warlock. That was Warlock. Because that one had like way too much spice. I mean, it tasted like somebody poured cinnamon in a glass. But this one is a lot more balanced. It tastes more like a spicy pumpkin pie. That Wicked was just straight up freaking cinnamon. According to their website, their description is, in the most worthy of pumpkin patches and during the silence of the midnight hour, the greater pumpkin rises up and pours a rich, deep, and burnished orange color. Heady aromas of bourbon, cinnamon, ginger, allspice, and clove linger seductively over the thick white head of this tremendous brew. It's love at the first sip as the full malt body dominated by British crystal malt, brown sugar, and pumpkin slowly washes over your tongue. Bourbon barrel aging rounds out the flavors with notes of oak, vanilla, and bourbon. Pairs well with crisp autumn weather, crunchy fallen leaves, and the knowledge that your kids will be asleep soon so you can raid the Halloween candy bags.
All right, you know what? With that description and the falling leaves, that's the reason I despise fall so much. I hate freaking getting up all the leaves, so I think that's the problem, is I automatically associate these flavors with what I spend my weekends doing now. So it's no longer cutting the grass, it's trying to keep the grass from dying, from getting covered with leaves and never seeing the light of day.
I just don't have any trees at my house, so it's all good.
Word. So, you know, for me, I'm at about a 3.75 on this beer. I mean, it's good. It's better than some of the pumpkin beers we've had, but it just isn't my palate.
I mean, this one right here, I might round it up to a 4 because I'm not a huge pumpkin drinker, but out of the ones I've tried, this is probably the best of the pumpkin ales I've had.
Absolutely. So we'll be sure to get this posted to Untappd, and you folks can share your ratings and feedback and tell us if we're, you know, completely stupid and don't appreciate the finer things in life.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
Hello, my name is Jay Patrick, and that is Adam.
Hello.
Join us for the Adam and JP Show.
Hello.
Available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
Hello.
Get it now.
Hello.
Oh, we're just kidding. If you love comics, video games, movies, wrestling.
Who doesn't? These are all great things that make us who we are.
That's true. Then you should join us for the Adam and JP Show. You actually can get it on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
Yeah, that part was true.
And right here on the ESO Network.
And adamandjp.com.
Yeah. science.
And we're back. It's time to get edumacated up in here, because it's time for science.
Hells yeah. What's on the agenda, man?
Science stuff. Do you know what a railgun is?
Yeah, it spits out a shitload of bullets in a very short amount of time.
No. A railgun is something that's, I mean, the government, I think we've got a few, like, Navy ships that have been experimenting. Something the military's been experimenting for years, but basically instead of a bullet being fired by, you know, powder or explosives like they are now, it's a gun that uses electromagnetic to fire a projectile. Basically, capacitors fire a metal thing that are accelerated through magnets and can go really, really fast.
So my definition describing what a railgun is off, but the fact that they shoot a shitload of bullets in a very short amount of time is not. Correct?
No, it only shoots like really one bullet. It just shoots it really, really fast using magnets and not gunpowder.
Okay.
A YouTuber named ZZ has built a homemade railgun that has like just, it's insane because it's he powers it with like a fuck ton of 9-volt batteries through 56 capacitors. And it, he has 56 480 joule capacitors. 1 joule is what it would take to move a 0.2 pound apple vertically 1 meter. This thing produces 25,000 joules of energy.
Nice. So I guess given that, it's a good thing all my surge protectors are rated for over 1,000 joules or something like that. Or maybe it's 1 million joules. I don't know. A bunch.
I mean, if you want to build one of these in your backyard, you can. It's just, like I said, it's kind of dangerous.
Yeah. I got houses? No. No good. No good.
Yeah, from the video, he's like out in the middle of a cornfield in the middle of nowhere when he fires this thing off. But yeah, there's so much power going through it that he basically has like jumper cables connecting the capacitors to the actual gun. And when he fires off, it blows like every single wire.
That's ridiculous.
So it's not something that you want to like, you know, pull the trigger yourself. You definitely want to get, you know, way far away when it goes off.
This is just got a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. I don't know that I feel educated by this. Like,
I mean, railguns are supposedly, you know, the future weapon, but yeah, trying to build these in your backyard, probably not the best idea.
All right, what's next on the agenda?
Speaking of bad ideas, Hassan Platin Institute. The Human Computer Interaction Lab of Germany's Hassan Platin Institute, if I'm even coming close to pronouncing that, has kind of built the first haptic suit for virtual reality where you can actually feel stuff in virtual reality.
Holy crap, that's epic. I'm kind of looking at the image of this thing like, damn, that's interesting.
Yeah, basically it's... if you ever use those like muscle exercisers that like, you know, shocks your muscles and makes them move, it's kind of a combination of that with a solenoid. So as you're like, it's done with like different like a fighting game is one of the things they demoed it with. So as you punch the solenoid or get hit, the solenoid, you know, kind of taps your skin to give you that, you know, sensation of an impact, and then the muscle electrodes will like shock your arm and make it like, you know, jump backward like it's actually getting hit by something. So you feel the impact and then your arm moves backward because the electrodes attached to it.
That's crazy. Like, there's some games I don't want to play. I don't It's got to be a safe word.
Yeah, I mean, they've had other systems they've tested. They can even attach these to like props. So if you're playing like a baseball game, you actually feel the impact of the ball on the bat. And like I said, with the fighting games, you can actually feel yourself getting punched. And they've linked, you know, several of these together into a, an actual like suit as well. So, you know, as the Oculus is being, you know, further developed, you know, seeing in virtual reality is one thing, but it's not going to be fully immersive until you can actually feel and manipulate objects in virtual reality. And this is like probably the first major step toward actually achieving that.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. Like, I just, everything that I read in Ready Player One, like, between this and Oculus and everything else, like, it's all coming full circle.
Yeah, the device is called Impacto, and it has a vibration motor combined with electrodes encased in light plastic box. Impacto delivers both stimulation to the muscles as well as pressure to the skin. It's attached to a band and worn on the arm, leg, or foot. You know, the whole device is self-contained, wireless, and, you know, like I said, it's basically your first thing to, you know, play some Mortal Kombat and feel yourself getting your ass kicked.
No. Yeah, that's kind of cool, though, but...
I do like the fact, you know, we talked earlier that it seems like a lot of these science articles I've had to learn, you know, mispronounce weird Japanese, Chinese names. The developer of this name, Pedro Lopez. So I can actually pronounce the the name of the person who has built this. That's the first time that's happened in a while.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's... I don't know, man. I mean, it's just really cool to see where, you know, development is taking folks and everything. I mean, you know, I could definitely see the gaming dynamic changing dramatically. Like, I mean, this may very well bring back a big resurgence of, you know, CPU and handheld gaming and, you know, things of that nature. I mean, I saw a virtual reality console where basically you plug your smartphone into a visor and, you know, you utilize it that way. So, I don't know, man. We're definitely on the brink of some cool technology.
I mean, that's basically all the Oculus uses anyway, is like cell phone screens. So it's not that, you know, big of a change, just, you know, to have something you can just plug your actual cell phone into and use. But yeah, this is going to be awesome, doing some gaming and stuff where you can actually, you know, I don't know if I want to catch Scorpion's spear to the chest, but it'd be kind of cool to at least, you know, feel the impact of a punch when I, you know, hit somebody.
I mean, you want to feel the impact of a punch? I got you right here.
Don't make me kick you in the nuts.
And you too can feel the impact.
Oh. And in other news, scientists have used a sonic screwdriver.
I got a sonic spork. Does that count for anything?
Have you ever heard of the blood-brain barrier?
No, do educate me.
Basically, your brain is protected by a lattice network of cells that let the good stuff in and keep anything that it deems bad out of the brain. The problem, I mean, and it does its job almost too well, because it's hard to get medication into the brain, say, you know, people with tumors and whatnot. You know, at this point, you actually have to cut into the, you know, brain area to deliver medication, and there's no way to do that without, you know, damaging that barrier and leaving it open to, you know, other infections, whatnot. But now they've finally found a way to, for the first time, can actually treat a brain through the blood-brain barrier without damaging the barrier, using something they're calling an ultrasonic screwdriver.
That's awesome.
Yeah, basically...
Big shout out to the Whovians here for making this possible.
Yeah, Dr. Todd Mainprize and Kalugo Heinemann. Basically, what they do is they place medication in these micro bubbles right next to the blood-brain barrier, and then vibrate the brain, the barrier, at 200,000 times per second using a ultrasonic blast. So, you know, basically sound waves, and it vibrates the lattice apart, and also the, like I said, the bubbles are contracting, expanding, it, you know, vibrating at 200,000 times per second, and it allows it to pass through into the brain where it needs to be without damaging the barrier and leaving you open for, you know, infection or whatnot.
That's awesome. What does this device look like?
I don't know. There's no pictures of how it turned out. But, I mean, it's some kind of, like, you know, sonic weapon of some kind.
I don't know if we could say sonic weapon. I mean, this is more like a sonic tool, I would say.
You're a sonic tool.
That's pretty awesome.
yes, the doctor would be proud. This time it's an actual doctor using the...
Doctor Who?
Dr. Main Prize from Toronto.
That was a failed attempt at making a joke. What do we got next, yo?
All right. You ever seen the movie Face Off?
I have.
Well, it's kind of coming real now.
And how's that?
Doctors at New York Langdon Medical Center has performed the most extensive face transplant ever.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm looking at some of the pictures. That is freaking amazing.
Yeah, a firefighter, a Mississippi firefighter, had basically a roof fall on him and burned him, like completely burned his face off. I mean, it was his entire face and it was just destroyed. So in a 26-hour operation, they reattached a face from a donor. And it's the first time, you know, and a surgery this extensively has been successful. I mean, they've attempted other surgeries like this in the past, but they've always, you know, rejected the new tissue and been complications in it. But so far, you know, this thing has been fully successful.
That is awesome. Yeah, I'm looking here. You know, 26 hours and a team of over 100 people. That is crazy.
Yeah, the main doctor, another one I could pronounce, Eduardo Rodriguez. and basically, they're treating him with anti redirection medication, you know, suppresses the body's natural, you know, reaction to fight off and reject stuff. So, you know, so far he is, you know, fully capable of functioning, and like I said, just looking at it, it's an amazing transformation from what he had before.
Man, that is crazy.
And the thing was, they originally gave him, like I said, it was like a 50% chance of survival. They're like, you know, there's no aborting this. Like, once you start the operation, if it fails, you're going to die. But yeah, you know, he went through it, and luckily, 26 hours later, he had a new face.
That's awesome, man. I mean, huge shout out, breakthroughs. I don't know, man. It's just amazing, you know, the way the technology and everything else is progressing, and the knowledge that people are learning. Like, you know, it makes you feel like there's some good in the world.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about prosthetics and stuff, but, you know, replacing an arm and a leg is way different than replacing, you know, an entire face. I mean, that's just amazing, the you know, scientific breakthroughs they're coming through now.
I think Leatherface would disagree. You know, he had that shit dialed in.
Yeah, but his wasn't, like, you know, very functional. They kind of rotted after a few days, and he had to kill another teenager to replenish it. This one, yeah, he's good to go.
True that.
And so, do you consider yourself a creative person?
At times.
Well, currently there's a new article written, 18 Habits of Highly Creative People.
Do I meet the criteria for all 18?
Let's see. Number one, they daydream. I'm definitely guilty of that, man. If I'm not busy doing something, my brain is like wandering down like a million scenarios. Even when I'm doing stuff, I'm like, I'm playing out like, you know, every possible freaking outcome in my head.
Yeah, I don't know about daydreaming, but I mean, you know, my brain definitely keeps me awake, and you know, the gears are always turning. So I think I probably make that list.
Number two, they observe everything. Yeah, I definitely look. But then again, that's probably like, you know, just a sign of paranoia from working security and stuff for a lot of years. Just I freaking have to do threat assessment on every person I see.
Situation yellow.
They work the hours that work for them. Creative people tend to work odd hours. Sometime, you know, either early morning or late at night is the typical schedule for a creative person. They take time for solitude, which... hanging out in the basement smoking cigars. I do that a lot. They turn life's obstacles around. Some of the biggest creative things have come from what would have been failure and, you know, gets turned around. They seek out new experiences. They fail up. In other words, they screw up and turn that screw up into something better. They ask the big questions. They people watch, which I definitely do that. they take risks. They view all of life as an opportunity for self-expression. They follow their true passions. I don't know what number I'm on now. They get out of their own heads. They lose track of time, which, yeah, I fucking do that a lot too. They surround themselves with beauty. Yeah, I don't think so. They connect the dots. They constantly shake things up. They make time for mindfulness, whatever the fuck that means. I think that's the end of it. Do you think any of those apply to you?
I definitely do. So, therefore, I think I'm creative.
All right. And well, in that, we'll go create some more podcasts, and we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in nerd news.
And it's a sad day in nerd news.
Aw.
Yeah. We're going to go ahead, get through the emotional heartbreak that we've all experienced. We lost a lot of great people so far in the month of November.
Since we last recorded, some of the, I would say, big wigs and at least in, you know, the nerd areas have passed away.
Absolutely. One of the biggest, you know, this guy's been an inspiration to me, you know, especially throughout high school and stuff like that, where our drama club had signed pictures of, you know, with Tobe Hooper, the director of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, as well as some signed stuff from Gunnar Hansen, the guy that originally played Leatherface. Yep. He passed away November 7th at the age of 68 due to pancreatic cancer.
Yep, the original Leatherface has finally passed away. Yeah, I mean, he was like an Icelandic actor who, I mean, if you see the pictures of him without the Leatherface mask on, he looks like a straight-up Viking dude.
I don't know, man. Like, I saw one, you know, and he's got the, you know, the Santa Claus white beard. And if he just let that grow out just a little bit longer, I mean, he could be a badass Saint Nick.
Yeah, I mean, everyone that I, you know, I have several friends that frequent conventions more than I do because I'm broke. But everyone who has ever, like, met him in person has said he is the nicest guy ever. I mean, it's like, does not fit his persona on screen. Apparently I've not found like anybody who could say a bad thing about him. And you know, he of course did the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre and a few other movies, and then pretty much gave up acting for a while. I mean, he became a writer, directed several documentaries, and finally came back into acting in the mid to late 80s and just basically did a whole bunch of like B horror movies.
Yeah, I mean, he actually did published a book, Chainsaw Confidential, in 2013, which basically detailed a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff on how the Texas Chainsaw films were made, and then, you know, revealed that one of the big inspirations behind the movie included, you know, the fairy tale Hansel and Gretel, which I thought was interesting.
Weird. Yeah, I know, he actually went and studied people with, you know, mentally disabled people to kind of come up with the persona of Leatherface, you know, because Leatherface is kind of a developmentally challenged. You know, he wasn't just like Jason, who was like a psycho for psycho's sake. He was kind of like almost childlike, and even though he was a bizarre, weird killer, that was the weirdest thing about Leatherface. You go from this imposing, friggin' serial killer to almost childlike at times.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole family history and everything else, you know, definitely alluded and played on that aspect of things. But, you know, I mean, Chainsaw's always going to have a special place in my heart.
If you want to see something weird, watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. It's just so different from the original.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, those movies, I feel like, unfortunately,
Dennis
did
Hopper.
did an injustice to the franchise in some ways. But, I mean, it's just tough for me. I hate to see the guy go, you know.
I recently watched Texas Chainsaw 3D, and that's a weird one.
Yeah. Doesn't even feel like any of the Chainsaw films or anything. Like, I don't know.
I mean, in that one, Leatherface is almost the hero. Because, like, the townspeople are trying to, like, you know, wipe out his family. And he's you almost start cheering for Leatherface at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, I mean, unfortunately, as fucked up as the family was and everything else, they stood together and they looked after one another. Not saying from a moral perspective, I condone, you know, the killings and everything of that nature, but, you know, they say blood's thicker than water, and they stood by one another, you know,
saw his family, as we've learned. But we also lost another nerd, or, you know, nerd icon, I'd say. If you've watched pretty much any movie with a car in it from, I don't know, since the 60s up to, like, you know, the mid-80s, most of those cars were built by one man, George Barris.
Yep. Yeah, and in fact, you know, I don't know, I kind of feel privileged. I was, you know, got my hands on the 1966 Batmobile, you know, scale model, and, you know, had it assembled last year, and, you know, I think it's kind of cool that, you know, I've got a, you know, freaking model car that I put several hours into investing off of. You know, this guy's exact, you know, work in the original 1966 Batmobile.
Yeah, I mean, he made the 66 Batmobile, the Munster Coach, the Beverly Hillbillies, a couple cars for Beverly Hills Billies, freaking Kit from Knight Rider was his, the General Lee, the Sarcy and Hutch Gran Torino, the Green Hornet from Bruce Lee's, whatever, Green Hornet, the Black Beauty from Green Hornet. And even made the Monkey Mobile, if anybody's seen that old show, The Monkeys.
So that's cool. I mean, I've got the, you know, freaking General Lee. I've got several of the cars in. I've got Kit. So.
And even his non-movie cars, if you go to his website, which we'll have a link to it in the show notes, I mean, he has been building cars, like, forever, nearly. I mean, even his, like, I mean, he's probably one of the premier car customizers of the last, you know, 40 years. You know, I mean, he was based in LA, so he did a lot of stuff for, you know, TV and movies and stuff. But even his you've seen these, like, crazy ass shit that Hot Wheels puts out, these weird customized cars. George Barris actually built that shit. I mean, there's, like, on his website, there's a picture of a guitar car he built. I mean, it's like live action Hot Wheels. It's just absolutely insane. And if you've ever been to, I know I've been to the Star Cars Museum up in Gatlinburg, and there's a few more of those museums scattered around the country. But most of the collection are George Barris cars. Like, so pretty much just about any, especially custom vehicle that's been in any movies, it came from this shop.
Yeah, that's just awesome. There's just so much creativity and ingenuity and everything else that goes into, you know, what these guys are doing. I mean, it's just freaking awesome. I mean, that's taken, you know, custom cars to a whole new level before, you know, I think it was really a mainstream thing. So I don't know, you know, another sad loss. And then we also had
go ahead. Probably my favorite car out of the George Barris collection is the Dragula from Munsters. The fucking dragster made out of a coffin. I saw it in person at the Star Cars Museum in Gatlinburg, and that thing is insane. Because it's no bigger than a coffin, but with this giant engine. It takes some probably balls to drive that thing.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I know what the Dragula is. You know, Rob Zombie makes references to it in some of his songs and stuff, too.
Watch some old Munsters, and they had, like, their car, which was almost like an old, you know, hearse funeral coach, but at one point that thing was like hot rotted out with big engines and stuff. But then at one point, Grandpa Munster, who, yeah, if you know anything about horror hosting, freaking, you know, Grandpa Munster is like famous forever. I mean, the dude even like, you know, I think became a congressman at one point. I mean, the dude was like insane. But there's one point where they challenge somebody trans him to like a drag race or whatever. So he like builds this dragster out of a coffin and races some dude. And like I said, that coffin dragster is probably the most insane customized job I have ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's crazy, man. I mean, hot rod culture and everything, like, I love it, dude. The artwork that goes behind it and, you know, the freaking rockabilly and psychobilly influences, I mean, and stuff.
How many 69 Chargers were destroyed in the making of Dukes of Hazzard? It's probably one of the hardest cars to find nowadays is an actual 69 Charger just for the amount that they destroyed back then. I think at one point Dodge had like a special assembly line just for Dukes of Hazzard cars. Because they were buying so many of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know, which I think it's kind of cool that we're seeing a resurgence of, you know, the older muscle cars, you know, with some of the updated technologies and stuff like that. Like, they still don't have that place that the older cars, I mean, they're classics, yeah. But, you know, still, I think it's cool that we're getting the Challengers and the Chargers and things of that nature.
Yeah, like I said, and they tried to remake Knight Rider a few years ago, but they turned Kit into a freaking Mustang. And I'm like, that just ain't cool. It's like the old ass 80s Trans Am is still my favorite Kit. So what else you got on the news front?
Well, we lost Michael Gross, who designed the Ghostbuster logo. And that's an iconic logo. I mean,
yeah.
I don't care if you're a nerd or not. Like, you see the Ghostbuster logo and you automatically know it's Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine recently take a trip to New York, and the firehouse that they, that firehouse that they used for Ghostbusters is still a functioning firehouse. And they have the Ghostbuster logo painted on like the sidewalk outside of the firehouse. You know, and that's that engine's like, you know, every engine company has its own logo, and that engine company still uses like a version of the Ghostbusters logo for their actual engine company.
Oh, that's awesome. So, you know, we lost Gunner to cancer, Michael Gross to cancer. I mean, I don't know, man. Hashtag it up. Fuck cancer. Let's find a cure for this shit. Like, we're losing too many people. Like, I don't know. Shit's just getting out of hand. All right. So let's shift gears a little bit on some happier notes. You know, one of the biggest things that came out, and the internet is just absolutely stark raving over this Netflix series, but Jessica Jones, we finally have the first season available on Netflix, and I gotta say, man, the duo between Marvel and Netflix is just absolutely killing it.
I mean,
because
I'm a huge Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fan, but the Netflix Marvel stuff is just killing it because they're not limited by what you can put on a network TV. I mean, there's... And even I would say, I mean, there's not been any nudity or anything like that, but just the...
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of sexual...
There's definitely some, like, you know, sexual content, but, you know, there's no nudity. But, I mean, when you can cuss, when you can show bloody violence, it's just... I mean, Marvel's never shied away from, except maybe during the, you know, Comics Code area, but it's so gritty and realistic, and I'm only two episodes in so far. You've seen like three episodes, and I'm hooked because at first I had no clue who Jessica Jones was. I never read this comic. I never heard of this character until now, but I'm digging it so far. I mean, I think
David Tennant playing, you know, the evil villain. I was like, how is that going to, you know, work? And now that I've seen, you know, a few of the episodes, I'm starting to be like, holy shit, like, this mashup, and then...
I mean, he's a brilliant actor, because, I mean, it just, you know, he's probably my favorite Doctor Who. But yeah, seeing him go evil is just, oh, it's freaking awesome. And even the guy who plays Luke Cage, too, because I've watched a lot of the newer Spider-Man animated series, and it features a lot of the guys who end up in the Netflix series. I mean, Iron Fist and Luke Cage feature heavily in the new Spider-Man cartoon. So I'm a little bit more familiar with that character than I am Jessica Jones, but it has a real...
I mean, that's the thing, man. You look at Punisher, you look at Jessica Jones, you know, Daredevil, like all these, you know, storylines that are based around Hell's Kitchen. I mean, Hell's Kitchen is dark, it's gritty, it's crime-riddled. Like, you know, I'm just absolutely stoked to see that we're getting to, you know, get that without having... You know, I mean, unfortunately, when some of these superhero films and stuff like that come out, I mean, you want to shy away from that R rating because that way, you know, folks are more likely to take the younger ones. If it gets that hard rating, then, you know, I think it's an automatic.
Yeah, but with Netflix, there's no censorship. Yeah. I mean, you have to, like, actually seek it out. So it's almost like watching something on HBO or whatever. So, yeah, it's probably even more violent than some of the, you know, the theatrical releases. And it kind of, because Jessica, if anyone who doesn't know the character, she is a former superhero who basically is suffering from PTSD because she was raped at some point. And, you know, they haven't really flat out said that in the show so far. Like I said, I'm only two episodes in, but she was mind controlled by this evil guy called Kilgrave who can basically control people with his minds. And so now she's like given up superheroing and is like kind of suffering PTSD and is making a living as a private detective. And it has a very much like film noir feel to it. So it's about a gritty private detective. And there's all these like, you know, self narration voiceover stuff that you see in some of those old film noir detective shows. So it's kind of like a modern interpretation of the film noir genre. So it's very different than Daredevil, but it's still just as good.
Yeah, absolutely. And while we're talking about Hell's Kitchen and everything, you know, Daredevil has finally got his own Funko Pop.
Oh shit, son.
Yep. So you know, and then we also get you know, the mask, Daredevil's mask vigilante, as well as Matt Murdock and Wilson Fisk. So, yeah.
I gotta say, my favorite scene so far in the new Jessica Jones is, like I said, since she's a private detective, she takes these kind of bullshit jobs at a law firm hires her to serve someone with lawsuit papers. and she tries to be nice and, like, you know, flirt with the guy, and he, like, tries to take off, and she's literally, like, lifts his car up off the ground so he can't drive away. And she's like, you know, you've got, like, powers or whatever. And she's like, yeah, I will melt your insides with my laser eyes and no one can tell the difference. So, here, take this serving at that. And she's like, dumbass, you believe I had laser eyes? It's just funny as shit. She's kind of, like I said, like, she's suffering from post-traumatic stress. So she's like, you know, so far, she's kind of like, you know, just like this weird alcoholic private investigator. it's weird. She's like, you know, a hero slash, like, you know, someone who just does not give a shit.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to switch gears a little bit as we wind down. So Sony is now working on bringing PlayStation 2 emulation to PS4 consoles, which I absolutely think is awesome because I, in my personal opinion, I feel like the PS2 probably had the best game lineup out of any system.
Yeah, that's probably the thing that's going to make me invest in a PS4 sooner rather than later. I mean, of course, I've got to play Battlefront. Like, everything I've watched of the new Battlefront game, it just looks freaking awesome. It's hopefully before the year's out, I'll finally upgrade to a PS4. But I'm trying to think. Like, some of the old, like, Resident Evil games from PS2, I would love to play those again. I
mean, you know, you had Square Enix, you know, with a lot of the Final Fantasy stuff. I mean, there's just been a ton of great games, and
I just want to be able to play the original Knights of the Old Republic.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing that the article alludes to as well, is, you know, there are three previously released Star Wars game. So these would be, you know, great emulations instead of just, you know, direct ports. So I don't know. I mean, you know, with the Star Wars movie and, you know, Battlefront and a lot of the new games that are going to be inspired from the movie.
Yeah, even
it would be awesome
older...
to go back and play, you know, some of the, you know, Battlefronts, the Battlefront 2, and some of the older, you know, PS2 games.
Yeah, even some of those older Mortal Kombats from PS2 and, like, the older, some of the older
yeah,
well, Resident Evil.
That was a disappointment for me over the last weekend. I had some people over and, like, are like, ah, shit, we don't feel like going downstairs and playing Mario Kart. But you know what? I got, you know, Mortal Kombat Deception. I think that's the one that's got combat carts on it. And I popped it into the PS4, and I'm like, shit, it's a PS2 game, not a PS3. We're not going to be able to play.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get the older Grand Theft Autos, the older Mortal Kombat. I mean, even some of the older Resident Evil games that came out on PS2. So, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to being able to do that once I upgrade to the PS4.
Absolutely. So,
I mean, I want to get an original NES at this point and play some of the old school games. Yeah, I used to kick ass at some original Mario.
Absolutely. Well, with that, folks, you know, final thoughts on the cigar here is, you know, this thing has remained rich, creamy, complex. I mean, this has been a damn good smoke.
Yeah, this may be one of my new favorites. I don't know where exactly to pick these up because, like I said, I got these from the Cigar Commander, but I believe if you go to Battleground's website, you can actually order them from there, or they can at least put you in contact with someone who can get them for you. I mean, hell, go on Facebook, look up the Cigar Commander, send him an email. He might be able to point you in the direction and get you some of these. You know, sometimes it's good to have friends in the cigar industry that can pass these on to us.
Absolutely.
And with that, check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. Check out our Facebook page, Facebook.com/CigarNerdsPodcast. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at CigarNerdPod. Go buy a cool Cigar Nerd shirt at either Zazzle.com or Real Men Smoke Cigars /CigarNerds. And remember, don't cross the streams. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.